just going to summarize the weekend by way of looking at the life of Merlin. Where the Vita Merlini begins, as I said earlier, is in the middle of life, where we have Merlin as a king at a battle, the end of the battle, when things have gone wrong. And his side has in fact won the battle, but it's been a terrible battle, and nobody's really won, because so many people have been killed. And we have him grieving for his nephews, and he's had a chapel built for their bodies to be housed. And his heart breaks, and he runs off into the forest. And as I think I said earlier, the forest is this place you find in the Arthurian tradition that represents the wild side, the imaginal side, the deep imagination, the place without order, but also the place of great fecundity, great life. In a certain sense, he abandons the king, he's a king, he's married to Gwendolina, his wife, he has a sister called Ganida, and who's married to King Colorado. And in a certain sense, what we're seeing here really is the playing out in the pattern of life of the earlier pattern that we've been looking at. We're also looking at some of the issues really about immersion in life. And in a certain sense, these are told in a very abbreviated form in a way in the prophecies of Merlin, because the need to awaken, to descend into the depths, to shed identity, to touch the root of life, and to re-emerge, right at the heart of this. I just want to read you a poem that doesn't have nothing at all to do with Arthurian tradition, but somehow encapsulates the whole of the journey that we've been looking at. So it's by a poet called Richard Berengarten from his collection called Changing, and the poem is called Shedding, and he's writing about a Taoist master called Xiao Yo, and his name roughly translates to the spontaneous free one. Before Xiao Yo effected changes in the world, in others, he changed himself. He went down into darkness and silence where he shedded things. Space-time, life and death, even his own breath. Then, from that core that is nothing and everything, a fire inexhaustible flowed, in streams through and along his fingers, to and into, whatever he touched. Were you who are lucky enough to meet him, charged to his charge, changed? And that sense of descent and shedding is what we find, we certainly do find that in the prophecies of Merlin, but the whole process really of the Vita Merlini is about this place of stripping and changing. So the first thing that in a sense that happens is first shedding that we find Merlin doing is he leaves his kingship, he leaves his home, he runs off into the wild woods and becomes a wild man living in the wood, living off nuts and berries and whatever roots he can gather. And he has his only companion is a wolf who accompanies him. And he's fine living like this until Windsor comes along. And then there begins this kind of cry from the heart, where he's crying out to the divine, in this case he's crying out to the Weaver Goddess, as to why do things have to be like this? Why can't it be summer all the time? But here I am alone in the woods, and all the leaves are falling from the trees, there's no shelter, even my wolf is dying. And so really he's speaking out of that place, that place that we were talking about just before the break, that place of somewhere not able to see a way through. And this happened on several occasions to him while he's in there, because he keeps running between the woods and the forest, and each time he ends up sort of crying out. And what happens is various responses happen. Not at all obvious responses. So he doesn't get an answer to his prayer. He's sitting there miserably in the wood when he encounters, well, he didn't encounter, his cries are heard by a messenger whom his sister has sent out, because they're all searching for him. And it's Ganeda, his sister, who's his other half, really, who in a certain sense is the Weaver Goddess, yeah. I mean, she's not named as such, she's just an earthly woman, but she is the director of all the action here in some ways. And so what she does is she sends out messengers all across the land to find him. One of these messengers hears him kind of lamenting and crying out. And this messenger, who is a minstrel or a bard, tries to approach him, but he flees even deeper into the woods, and he manages to find an even deeper place in the wood where there are hazelnuts and where there is a spring and where he can sustain himself. But eventually the minstrel kind of finds him and sings to him of the beauty of his wife Gwendolina and how sad Gwendolina is. And he is drawn back toward the city by his image of Gwendolina. And what we see happening in this first iteration is that he is given this image of Gwendolina, he's soothed by the kind of music, and he's drawn back into the city, into the world of human life, away from the wild place, the place of the deep imaginal, into the world of human relationship. And his wife and his sister are very glad to see him, and his brother-in-law is very glad to see him, and they give him a lot of honour, and everybody's delighted for him. But what happens to him as he enters into the world of the city? He cannot bear to be around people. He feels his kind of wildness, his madness erupts in him, and he's longing to go back to the city, and they become very worried for him, so he's kept under guard, and he has music played, but the music doesn't work this time. They say that Brother the King went to him and begged and prayed him to be reasonable, to stay with him and not to hanker after the forest and an animal life under the trees, when he might wield a royal scepter and rule a nation of warriors. The king promised that besides he would make him many gifts. He ordered clothes to be brought, and hunting birds and dogs and fast horses, gold, glittering gems and cups, wrought by Waylands. Wayland is the great magical smith in the city of Saguntium. All these Rodach brought to the prophet, urging him to stay and forget the woods. But the prophet rejected the present in these words: "Let these singers go to lords hard pressed by poverty, such are not content with modest living, but can covet everything. But I put above these things the woodland and the spreading oaks of Caledon, the high hills, the green meadows at their foot. These are for me, not these things. Take back your goods, King Rodach. My nut-rich forest of Caledon shall have me. I desire it above all else." At last, finding no guilt to detain the sullen man, the king ordered him to be stoutly chained to prevent him from setting off for the forest wilderness. The prophet felt the chains about him and saw no way to be free to get to the wind of the woods of Caledon. He fell into a gloom and stayed silent. His face lost its liveliness. Not a word, not a smile would he vouchsafe. So here you see him really captured after that experience of the kind of the mystery of the forest, even with the hardness of the forest, coming back from the sort of the depth into the surface, drawn back onto the surface, and not being able to bear it, no matter how many blandishments, how many glittering things he's given. He longs for the depths of the forest. He longs for whatever he's found there. And then something really interesting happens, because the king, because he's chained up, and this is the deep images you find in the soul of Britain, which you know is in the arms of Warwickshire, is you have this image of the chained bear, who is the defender of the tree of life. And in a certain sense, the figure of Merlin is in a direct line from figures like Math, son of Mathonwy, Bear, the son of the one who is like a bear. And so it is a certain way in which he is the bear shaman who is chained in the city, and whom they want, it's like that horrible thing which they certainly did a lot in the Middle Ages, and you can still see in parts of Turkey sometimes, where they get bears to dance for the amusement of the people. And there's something about this wild, powerful being, this wild man, green man, mysterious green prophet, chained up silent in the middle of the city. And sad. And what happens now is what we start to see happening in the story is his magical insight, his ability to see through things, starts to come into play. For the queen, his sister and Rodach are walking, coming to see him. And the queen has a leaf in her hair. And the king smiles at her and pulls the leaf out of her hair. And you get this very powerful thing that happens in the stories of Merlin. He utters a great laugh. And it's this kind of laugh that kind of stops the world. And it made the men standing nearby to look at him in surprise, because he'd been refusing to laugh. The king was also surprised and pressed him to account for his unexpected laughter. Merlin stayed silent and avoided an explanation of his laughter, but Rodach continued to press him more and more, giving him presents. At length the prophet grew angry at Rodach's generosity and said, "I will let the miser take back his gifts. Gifts do not buy me. Unless I get my freedom and may go back to the green woodland valleys, I refuse to explain my laughter." So as he had failed to change the prophet's mind by any gift, he ordered the chains to be struck off and gave him permission, as long as he is willing to give explanation. And so Merlin, now his spirits now rising because he could leave, said, "The reason I laughed, Rodach, was that one and the same act you earned both approval and disapproval. When just now you pulled out the leaf the queen unknowingly had in her hair, you are more faithful to her than she had been to you, when she crept into the undergrowth where her lover met her and lay with her. As she lay there, a leaf fallen by chance caught in her loosened hair. You plucked it out unknowing." So Rodach then's very angry and says to his wife, "Why are you so angry?" But he says, well, why would you believe him? And you know, because he's mad. We all know he's mad. And so she decides to show to Radhak that he's completely, his gifts are completely unreliable. And there's a particular, but there's a pretty interesting phrase. In the hall, there is a particular boy. Now, this phrase, a particular boy, is kind of quite important. It has the meaning of a special boy. It has this sense of the magical child, the magical boy. And she noticed him and then thought of an ingenious trick to show up Merlin. She called the boy over and asked him to predict the death the boy would die. So her brother said to her, "Dear sister, when he is a man, this lad will die by falling from a high rock." So then the queen tells him to go away, take off the clothes he's wearing, put on others, cut off his long hair, so that he comes in again looking like a different person. The boy did what he was told, and he returned to them in different clothes as instructed. After a little while, the queen once more appealed to her brother, saying, "My dear, tell your sister what the death of this one will be." Merlin said, "When this boy grows up, he will meet a violent death in a tree through misjudgment." So the queen says to her husband, "Look, he's making no sense at all, but I'll show you one more time, just to you to make sure of this." So saying, she got the boy to go out, dress himself in woman's clothes, and come back. So he does this, he comes back in woman's clothing, looking like a girl. And then the queen says to Merlin, "Well, brother, tell me of the death of this girl." "Girl or not," said her brother to her, "she will die in a river." And so Radhak is reassured because Merlin's quite clearly crazy. He's the same person. He's prophesied three entirely different deaths. Come back to this in just a second, but so he then is free then to go back into the wildwood, and what happens then is that Grendelina begs him to stay because she's very sad, and there's a place where he repudiates Grendelina, And in a certain sense, this is kind of quite subtle. It looks kind of like all the brutal. But it's actually this place where he's stripping himself of his identities. So he's already losing his identity as a king, as a monarch, as a... But and also now his of his sexual identity. And in a certain sense, the thing that had drawn him back into... the city, not his actual love for Grendelina, but his image of Grendelina as this beautiful woman. And so the stripping away of that objectified sexuality is what's being shown to us in this. And he says that, you know, it's fine for her to go and marry somebody else, but he doesn't want to know about it. And Grendelina is very sad. So he goes off then into the wildwood, and then we come back to the story of the boy. They thought he had lied about the boy's death in speaking of three deaths when he ought to have spoken of only one. For so many long years, his pronouncement seemed an empty one until the boy himself reached manhood. Then its force became universally apparent, and many were convinced. While hunting with a pack of dogs, the youth saw a stag hiding in the forest undergrowth. He unleashed the dogs. At the sight of the stag, they tore upwards along the rough tracks, filling the air with their baying. He spurred his horse in pursuit, directing the huntsmen by sounding his horn, by shouting, and urged them to come on with greater speed. There was a high hill ringed with rocks, with a river running across the plain at his foot. The quarry crossed the hill, fled towards the river in search of his usual cover. The young man pressed on and took a straight course over the mountain, looking for the stag among the scattered rocks. But in his headlong course, his horse happened to slip and went over a high precipice. Its rider plunged down the steep cliff stove into the river, but he fell in such a way that one foot caught in a tree, and the rest of his body was submerged in the flowing stream. So then he fell, he drowned, he hung from a tree, and by his triple death he proved the prophet a true one. Now this is a very ancient motive, the motive of the triple deaths. It's something you find in Celtic tradition. You find it, for example, in the man who was buried in Lindo Moss outside Old Liège, who was strangled, is struck and drowned. And interestingly also you find it in the tarot pack in Tarot Trump 12, where you have the figure hanging by his foot from a tree, and with a pool of water underneath him. And this is the triple descent. This is the descent into the foundations, into the pool of life, into the opposites. And this is this figure who is one thing and then another thing, is male and female. This is the sense of the son or the daughter of light that emerges out of the unknown and who enters into this, enters into this mysterious triple transition. So enters into the land, enters into the solar system, enters into the stars, enters into the triple world. So this is like a hinge point in the middle of this book, really, that's told as a little aside, but there's a whole wealth of symbolism and meaning connected to it. And in fact, you know, there's a whole lot of stuff about he's following the magical stag. It's the ancient, if you remember the story of Pwyll and the Mabinogion, who follows a magical stag into the forest and is met by Arawn, who's the otherworldly lord, who's a lord of the kingdom of death as opposed to the living kingdom that Pwyll represents. All these are sort of a kind of wrapped up in this image, but also with the image of what is true and what is illusory. And we went to the idea that the deep knowing appears nonsensical on the surface of the world. So then what we find is that he returns existing on frozen moss, apparently, which satisfies him more than the administering the laws in the city and ruling over his warriors. And meanwhile, the years go by, and he's living in the woods. He's got a flock of animals. And Gwendolina eventually becomes promised in marriage to somebody else. And he's sitting in the forest, and it was night, and the horned moon was shining brightly. All the lights of the vault of heaven were glittering. The air had an extra clarity, for a bitterly cold north wind had blown away the clouds, absorbed the mists on his drying breath, and left the sky serene again. He was watching the stars in their course from a high hill. He was out into the open, talking to himself and saying, "What means this ray from Mars? Does this new and ruddy glow mean a king dead and a king to be? I see it so. Constantine has died, and by an evil chance his nephew Conan has seized the crown through the murder of an uncle and his king. Highest Venus, you sail within your prescribed bounds in company with the sun in its path between the zodiac. But what now of your twin ray, cutting through the ether? Does this division foretell the parting of my love, such as the ray that speaks of love divided? Perhaps Gwendolina has abandoned me now the time away. Perhaps she is happy in the close embrace of another man. So I lose her, another wins her. My rights are taken from me while I linger here. Indeed, a laggard lover loses to the lover who is not a laggard, nor absent, but near and urgent. Yet I bear no grudge. She may now marry, now the time is right, and with my permission enjoy a new husband. When tomorrow dawns, I will go and take with me the present I promised her when I left. So he sets off around the woods in the clearing and organizes a herd of stags into a single line. Also does and ushigos, he seats himself in a stag, and at the coming of the day, he sets off, driving his lines before him. And so he comes with speed to the place of Gwendolina's wedding, and the stags stand quietly outside the gates. And then shouts, Gwendolina, Gwendolina, come out, what presents are looking for you? She came out quickly and all smiles, and astonished to see a man riding a stag and it obeying him. Astonished so many animals of the wild could be brought together. And that he alone was driving them before him like a shepherd, accustomed to taking his sheep to pasture. The bridegroom was standing at a high window, looking in amazement at the rider on his seat, and he broke into a laugh. When the prophet saw him and realized who he was, he promptly wrenched off the horns of the stag he rode, he whirled them round and threw them at the bridegroom, crushing his head, knocking him lifeless, and drove his spirit to the winds. In a moment he dug his heels into a stag and set it flying on his way back to the woods. But then as he's going back across the stream, he slips and falls into the fast torrent and once again is captured. So there's a whole territory here, really, of him having shed. We see him in the wood, consulting the stars, being a hermit, but connected to everything. And we see him apparently accepting that Gwendolina has moved on, but partly because of the disrespect of the bridegroom in laughing at him. His jealousy and his rage mounts up, and he kills the bridegroom. Which means then he gets captured again. So he gets caught, literally caught. He ends up back in the city, being bound again. Once again, being miserable, and refusing to eat. And this time, Radach says, "Well, let's take him out into the city, into the marketplace. Let's hope to, you know, to try and jolly him up by all the things that are going on in the city." And he's taken out. On the way to the palace, he sees a badly dressed servant in front of the gates. He was the doorman, and he was begging people. And then he stops, and then he laughs. And then further on, he sees a young man with new shoes in his hand, purchasing leather patches. He laughs again. Then he wouldn't go any further, because he just wants to be back in the forest. Servants tell the king about the story of the two laughs. And his attempt turns the words, and once again now we get this, will you tell me? No, I won't. Only will if you let me go again. And I'll explain to you what my laugh's about if you let me go into the city. Let me go from the city back into the forest. And the Merlin then explains it. The doorman in front of the gates, sitting in shabby clothes and begging, was secretly rich, for he hath a secret hoard of coins under him. So I laughed, turn up the earth beneath him, you'll find coins that have been hidden there for a long time. From there, then you took me to the marketplace and saw a man buying shoes with patches to repair when his shoes are whole worn and whole by use. I laughed again, he was this poor fellow who would be in no position to use his shoes or fix the extra patches on them later. He is already drowned and floating into shore. Go and see for yourself. So they do that, and then they find, yes, that there is indeed a hoard of coins. And they do find the drowned youth. Now these are these kind of images of the drowned youth who is immersed in the waters and floating into shore. Is an image of course of death and the unexpectedness of death and the mystery of death. The doorman is the mystery of the doorman that we find as the doorman genus. So what's being sort of unfolded in his visions while he's in the city, we find the mystical triple death. We find the mystery of being the doorman. We find that mystery of the death that is the immersion in the deep waters. And what then happens is that he wants to go back to the city, but this time he and Ganida have a dialogue where, in order to stop this, and there's something really about this whole process of the movement into the city, the interplay between the green world and the depths and the surface world. That starts to create a bridge, and the bridge is in this sense of the bridge is the triple death, which is connected to the great oak, to the world tree, the contemplation of the doorman of the mysteries, and the experience of the death that is the immersion in the waters of life, the immersion in the great sea, that then enables an integration, a creation. So what is then built is an observatory, not in a high place, but in the deepest place of the forest. But what happens then, instead of being wild and free in the forest, a structure is created in the middle of the forest. So it's the bringing together of the city and the forest. And if we remember that earlier image of the goddess of the land who holds the city in one hand and the wood in the other hand, and this sense of the drying up of the streams of the hunger for life and the hunger for death. This is this place of then the integration of the opposites, of the coming together into the, where the green wood and the city kind of live together. And the later what happens is that Radach dies and Ganida comes and joins him in this place. And so we have this place that's rather like the art on the Tree of Life. It's this mysterious place that's in between everything but connected to everything. And it says it's a place that has, I think it's 140 windows. No, 70 doors and windows. It's basically got 70 doors. I don't think there's anything particular about the number there, really. But anyway, it's a place of many, the whole idea, it's a place of many doors. It's a place of many doors and windows. So this place is gives you access to many different dimensions. Many, you can see many things, you can step in to many different places. It's a mysterious place, connected to all places. And the coming together of him and Ganida in this place is this real place of the joining of the opposites and in a certain sense we could say the embodiment of the mysteries of the weaver and the prophet of the weaver. So this is a sort of coming together in the outer world of these deep mysteries we've glimpsed through the prophecies of Merlin. And what then happens is that you see then a whole series of prophecies that are like the prophecies of Merlin that describe the nature of the world as they understood it in Geoffrey of Monmouth's time. So what we're being shown from this place is a connection, this place that he operates from connects you to all other places. So you get lots of descriptions of Britain, of the islands of Britain. You get descriptions really of of the flow of history, of the coming of Arthur, of the whole. So you get, so there's a whole sense of you're in this kind of magical place where you're connected to all of the places of the world and connected to all of the times. And there's all kind of worth looking at. There's lots of kind of interesting kind of material, really. And then as they notice this, Taliesin turns up with Minerva. And here we have another version of the goddess and the sun and a child. So again, it's slightly classicized. Would have been for the bards, Ceridwen and Taliesin would turn up. So again, the son of the mother, the mother and the son. Son, behold your mother. Mother, behold your son. That sense of the ground state and the messenger or prophet of the goddess turns up and shows him shows Ganeden the creation of the world and the unfolding of the world from the four winds, the four elements, and there's a description really of the cosmos as it was understood in medieval times. It's really looking at the way in which everything is connected. So we get to see the way the winds work. We also get to see the way the underground waters and the waters of the seas work. So that we're being invited into a vision of the world that's more and more kind of connected and everything related to each other. We get to learn about fish. We get to learn about birds. We get to learn about animals. And there's a particular focus on Britain, that the Britain is considered I'm talking about places that have a reputation for fertility. Britain is considered first and best among these. It offers its bounty every manner of things, yields crops which year by year contribute their noble gifts of grain for man's use, woodland and pastures where honey drips, airy mountains and broad green meadowlands, springs and rivers, fish, cattle and wild creatures, fruit trees, jewels and special precious metals, and all else that creative nature can supply. In particular, there are health-giving springs, whose hot waters do the sick good and provide welcome baths for them, after which their illness subsiding, they are sent away. Bladud established his bath during his reign, and he named them after his consort Alaron. And so this is the health spring, the springs of Bath, and the connection with the goddess Minerva Sulis, and the sense of the life-giving spring that arises out of the ground. So this is like a compendium, really, of all kinds of. He talks also about the Hesperides, where the golden apples of the sun can be found in Greek myth. So he's bringing together Greek and Celtic traditions as a kind of encyclopedia of magical images, all of which can be contemplated. But contemplated from the nature of being in Merlin's, enclosure, of being in Merlin's tower, where we take any one of these, and by contemplating any one of these images and places, see how it connects to everything else. We find a description of Avalon here as well. The island of apples gets its name, the fortunate island, for the fact it produces all manner of plants spontaneously, needs no farmers to plough the fields. There's no cultivation of the land at all, beyond that which is nature's work. It produces crops in abundance, grapes without help. Apple trees spring up from the short grass in its woods. All plants, not merely grass alone, grow spontaneously, and men live 100 years or more. This is the place where 9 sisters exercise a kindly rule over those who come to them. The one who is first among them has greater skill in healing, as her beauty surpasses that of others. Her name is Morgan, and she has learned the uses of all plants in the curing of the ills of the body. She knows too the art of changing her shape, of flying through the air like Daedalus on strange wings. At will she is now in Brest, now at Chartres, now at Pavia, and at will she glides down from the sky onto your shores. They say she has taught astrology to her sisters. It is there that we took Arthur after the Battle of Camlann, where he had been wounded. Berinthus was the steersman because of his knowledge of the stars and seas of heaven. With him at the tiller of the ship, we arrived at the prince, and Morgan received us with due honour. She put the king in her chamber on a golden bed, uncovered his wound with her noble hand, and looked long at it. At length she said he could be cured if only he stayed with her a long time and accepted her treatment. We therefore happily committed the king to her care and spread out our sails to favourable winds on our return journey. And so there's that end of the description of what life is like after Arthur's time. And there's a lot of description. And then there's also the description of Hengist and Horsa and the backstory to Arthur. And so we come then to, you know, it's not a linear narrative at all. We've heard about where Arthur ends up after the Battle of Camlann, and then we get the story of Arthur. And then we get the story ends by saying on that field also the king was mortally wounded and left the kingdom. And as was described, he sailed over the water and came to the palace of the nymphs. Each of the two sons of Modred intended to seize the kingdom for themselves. They fought, and each in turn murdered his near kid. Then the king's nephew, Prince Constantine, rebelled against them, harried their supporters and cities, and when they were brought low and had both met a harsh death, he assumed the crown and took over the management of the nation. His peace did not last, for his kinsman Conan organized a formidable campaign against him. Conan caused general destruction, killed the king, seized the territories over which he now exercises a weak and witless control. Now, if you remember an earlier part of the narrative, we see Merlin perceiving that as if it's happening in real time at an earlier point. And again, this is to do with the fact that in the Wildwood, in the place of mystery, all times are available to him. Now, the final act, in a sense, really, of the Vita Merlini is as if prophecy is being uttered. Retainers rushed up and said, told him a new spring had broken out at the foot of the mountain, and streams of pure water were gushing out, running far down along the hollow of the valley, and rippling across the pastures. So he and Ganeda going down to see the new spring. And after a while, Merlin feels thirsty and bends over the spring. He drinks freely and bathes his temples. And as the liquid passed through the internal passages of stomach and bowels, it settled the humours of his system. He suddenly recovered his mental balance and came to himself, losing all trace of madness. Feeling long dormant in him returned also. He became healthy and whole once more. And he's there now with Taliesin, with Ganeda. And as they're there in this place, they then contemplate the nature of streams, the nature of killing streams, healthful streams. And it goes on to several pages, really. It is a kind of encyclopedia of magical images, as they were known at that time. And then there's lots of places. The Vita Merlini is really worth studying because there's lots of images in here that are kind of quite powerful, very easily. So there's very easily kind of missed. And so then there's a story about how he's been cured of the magical spring, and everybody comes to see him, and being because now he's cured, and he's asked to resume his kingly position, but he doesn't want to do that. And then we have a very powerful kind of image, which is very, very easily missed. The stanzas, he talks about the beauty of his wood. The stands in that wood, an oak rugged and full of years, now so worn by the passage of all devouring time, that the sap is failing and it's rotting through. I saw this tree when it had just begun to grow, and I saw the acorn from which it sprung as it chanced to fall, while the woodpecker perched above it and watched the branch. Here I have seen that acorn grow unaided, observing every detail. I felt a deep respect for it standing there in the clearing, and I marked this spot in my memory. And then he moves on, really, to look at magical kind of animals. But this is there's a number of things from this image of the oak, but the particular oak, which is the magical tree of life. It is Merlin's oak. And the story, really, which is about the oak, the renewal of the oakman, the renewal of the oak. We also get a sense of that he is this immensely ancient figure. So the story has been travelling as if it's in quite linear kind of time. This happens, that happens. You know, it doesn't feel like it's taking very long, any of this. And then suddenly we discover he is a very, very ancient figure who has watched an oak grow from an acorn that now has become a rotten oak, an oak that is dying. And in a sense, we suddenly realize that he is the oak man. And the life of the oak is linked also to his own renewal. And there's a contemplation, which we don't have time to do today, where you can enter into the oak, enter into the brokenness of the oak, the age of the oak, and by identifying with it, and by identifying your own sovereignty with the sovereignty of the oak, discover the life within the broken, the rotten, the old, and bring about the renewal. So he moves on then with the contemplation of magical birds. But then what really is properly the final act, there are more prophecies that go on here, but the final proper act is while they're standing really by this great oak, which actually is the same place that the spring comes from. In the center point of the center point of the forest. As he finished speaking, a madman came up to them unexpectedly, or perhaps fate had brought him. He filled the forest air with a terrible noise, made threatening gestures, foamed at the mouth like a wild boar. Quickly caught the man and made him sit down to get laughter and jokes out of what he would say, because they needed to make fun of him. Taliesin the bard looked at him more attentively, realized who he was, and gave a deep sigh. This is not how he once looked when we were in the flower of our youth. At this time he was a strong, handsome soldier in whom the nobility of royal descent was patent. He was my companion in the days of my prosperity. I was considered to be lucky, and I was to have such good friends. But one day we happened to be hunting in the high mountains of Awesti, and came to a spot under an oak, where the spreading branches stretched toward the sky. The spring was flowing there in a circle of green grass. Its water was good for drinking. We were all parched, so we sat and drank greedily of the pure stream water. Then we saw fragrant apples lying on the soft grass of the familiar bank of the spring. The man who had first come upon them, gathered them, gave them to me, laughing over our unexpected present. I handed the gift of apples round to my friends, but left myself without any because the pie was not large enough. Those who received the apples laughed and called me generous. Then they eagerly fell to and ate them up, complaining that it was so few. In a moment of pitiable madness seized this man here and all the others. Soon they were out of their minds, bit and scratched each other like dogs, screamed, foamed at the mouth, and rolled demented on the ground. Then they dispersed and went off, filling the air with pitiful howlings like wolves. I think these apples must have been a gift intended for me, not for them. I later learned this was so, that there was living in these parts a woman who had been attached to me and fulfilled her love of me for many years. After I had discarded her and refused to cohabit with her, she soon developed a vicious determination to harm me and placed a poison-smeared gift at the spring. I beg you now, he's speaking to Merlin, get this man to drink from the clear healing water from the spring. So if he is capable of recovering his sanity, he may do so and come to himself. Then he can come to work with me among these groves for the remainder of his life. And so they do this, and he takes the water, like Merlin, he's cured, and recognizes Taliesin and Merlin as his friends. And what then happens is he and Ganeda and Merlin and Taliesin live together in the hermitage and in the woods. Now what this last piece is about is the sense of the goddess, of the taking aspect of the goddess. This is the goddess who brings death, who brings madness. This is the Robert Graves, who in a way writes very powerfully about this aspect of the goddess when he talks about the white goddess, who is the inspirer but who is also the killer and bringing to life. So this is the. And in a certain sense, Maedlin, who is this figure, the madman, is a sort of another version of Merlin, somehow. And he is the, if you like, the person, so in a certain sense, we have Merlin, who is the servant of the goddess, the great weaver goddess, we have Taliesin, who is the servant of Ceridwen and the servants of creation. We have the Merlin represents the weaver who is both life and death. Ceridwen is about the energy of creation. The death goddess, the white goddess, is about the energy of death. And so we have life and death together with that third principle. And the person who, in a sense, embodies all three of these principles is Ganeda, who is herself the weaver, who weaves all things together. And so that's really where our story ends, really, in this mysterious place in the forest, that's in the deepest place of the earth, that is also in the stars, that brings together all the energies of the world, because what's been described in the book are all the energies, everything. All the lands, all the waters, all the animals, all the birds. We've had this powerful sense of prophecy, so all of time is in here as well. And we have this sense of the coming together of these principles in this kind of mysterious place. In a certain sense, it all, in a sense, condenses back down, really, into the sense of the... So we have the four, but the four are really the two that is the one. The sense of being the mother who is the son who is the mother, the weaver and the doorman. So the, in a certain sense, what the Vita Merlini does is expand the themes of the prophecies and shows us this and gives us many, many potential images to contemplate. And so that all of which then lead us back to the singular point of this mysterious place. So that's a bit of a whistle-stop tour through the whole of the Vita Merlini, which is this... And we have to remember when these books are written, right? So these books are written when there are not many books. You know, books are these hand-copied, incredibly valuable things. So anyone possessing a manuscript like this would be contemplating it for years, and it's written in that way, so the compressed meaning inside this. It's in terms of that text, what's written in it is written, the description of the world is from an encyclopedia called by Isidore of Seville, which is a compendium of all that is known about the world at that time. Now our equivalent to that would be to read everything we can about physics and biology and geography and kinds of and astrophysics. And it holds inside it the idea of unity and multiplicity. So what the prophecies give us is the sense of the profound principles, which then, and then we are shown the living out of that, of those principles in the human life of Merlin. But there are these strange disarranging things that happen. So we find that time doesn't really seem to happen in the normal way. We're told the future before we learn of the past. We discover that while all of this, the story seems to be happening in what would seem to be like a normal storytelling timescale, we discover, well, he actually is this immensely ancient figure who's been watching an oak since it was an acorn, and now the oak's nearly dead. And so the person contemplating this, having understood the principles that are found in the prophecies of Merlin, this would be like a sort of a book of magic, a grimoire, where they would work with these particular images, identifying themselves with the images, shape-shifting into those images, imagining themselves into the different positions, being Merlin, being Ganeda, being Rodach, being the drowned young man, being the figure in the who falls from the height into the triple death. So they are genuinely, in that sense, initiatory documents. We'll come back to them, because there's a great deal in it. But this, you can see what this does and what he achieves in both the history of the kings of Britain and in this Vita Merlini, is this is why he creates the basis of something that then becomes this enormous kind of literature, where people become inspired by it and write their own versions of it. And what's notable really in the of both the prophecies and in the Vita is there is no description of Christian imagery. Find that later in Malory and in some of Malory's predecessors, particularly some of the Cistercian texts or the Grail. But in the actual descriptions of Geoffrey of Monmouth, you don't find any overt religion. Except what you do find are these, well, apart from the image of the weaver goddess, and the sense of Ariane and the goddess of the lands, you find a very ancient kind of ancient image, which he does it in a clever way, because he's using it as obscure prophecies, kind of gets away with it because of that, because people don't understand. But And in a way, I suppose that's why Geoffrey Monmouth is so important. And the way we, if we understand really the later legends and the way they are told and retold through his eyes, we start to see something quite different from the normal way that the story of Arthur is shown. Because ultimately it is about true sovereignty. It is about these magical transformations and becoming both the servant of the weaver and the apprentice to Merlin. And in a sense, these, both the Vita Merlini and the prophecies of Merlin, which I've sent these out to you much earlier on. So if you're curious about Merlin, just read through them. Read them lightly. Don't get into them as you need to kind of understand. See what calls your attention. Treat them as magical books that will talk to you and will talk back to you if you get curious about them. Imagine yourself into them. Okay, so we've got about a quarter hour left. Let's see if there's any thoughts or questions about all that. Well, it isn't really about her adultery, actually. What the point of that piece of the story is about how he sees beneath the surface of things. Right, so the whole point of that story, really, is that he sees into the depths and he understands something that is not understood on the surface. And then we have this interplay, and then we have her re-establishing that kind of illusory kind of framework around herself. You know, it's like the kind of Eastern idea of Maya, of illusion, of the way things look being different from the way they are. And it's a particularly clever bit of the story, this, because actually he embeds within that bit of the story not just the idea that Merlin does see deeper beneath the surface. Well, that's why it's a hinge point in the story. He shows us the triple death, the triple descent. You know, the sense of the falling from the earth, from the height into the depths, into the mystery of the living tree, into the deep waters. Different symbolism, but it's the same thing that happens when Merlin looks into the foundations of the tower. He looks into the foundations, he looks into the pool, he looks into the place of the dragons. It's that, again, that triple descent. It is a triple transformation and a triple death. And it also is this very ancient Celtic motif that you find in. You find the same thing when you look at towards the end of the fourth branch of the Mabinogion, when Clive, who's in his rotting eagle form, is called and has to make three descents down into the arms of Gwydion. So there's the sense of the triple movement into the deep. Yes. Yes, she has, exactly that. Yeah. No, that's right. No, so she's orchestrating it. She is the mysterious weaver here. So everything within this, right? So even the infidelity, even the, is part of this much more mysterious weaving. So in a sense, the whole thing about this text of Vita Merlini is that you read it first of all, it looks fairly obvious, but none of it is actually obvious. It's a very surreal and odd kind of text when you look at it. It looks more straightforward than the prophecies, because the prophecies have all these mad images and shifts and changes and things. And so it's a more orderly seeming text. But beneath the surface, you suddenly notice all these shifts. You've heard about the death of Constantine earlier on because you've seen it happening. And then later on you're being told that's something that hasn't happened yet, or maybe has happened yet, because you're loose in time. So there's a whole, and in a certain sense, the key thing underneath this really is understanding that all of this is the weaving of the weaver goddess that Ganida is representative of somewhere. Yeah, sure. It's probably a good idea. I think you might have sent them at the beginning of the course about. So yeah, I'll do that. Yeah, no, fine. I'll send it. So any other questions about anything for the weekend, really? So maybe about this, but about anything else. Let's just see what's needed just as we finish today. Yeah. It's not quite as, well, it can be. The stag can be seen as Christ. It's not really used in this particular set of symbols like that. The stag that's seen in the prophecies is much more the archetypal masculine energy, it's got a slightly different connotation. The stag is the primordial male energy, but he's also, if we think more broadly about the stag, not so much within the context of the story, because it's a, really about the encounter of the stag encounter is the represents the male kind of energy here. So that's where we have Merlin riding on the stag, driving the stags, and he is almost the archetypal stag, the wild man who wears the horns of the stag. And there's a way in which, you know, you can see that energy is also related to the energy of the Christ. But it's not there are other places where the stag is seen as the Christ energy bringing people into the, you know, towards the service of the Grail, which is a different, related but different story in a way. It's just a stag. In the stories of the Grail, you find a white magical stag. And in other places in the Arthurian legend, is the white stag leads them off. And in the Merlin stories, he's just a stag. In the prophecies, he's a white stag with a crown. So that's a, that, you know, that's a sort of, to emphasize that he's a magical crown stag. When they, sorry. That's not so much the lid. That's, I think I was talking about the Kalech, where the old, no, that's a different image. So that's the Irish legend of the Kalech, who is the goddess of the winter time, the mountain mother, who travels with the great bull, and it's that sense of the ancient masculine, the ancient feminine, together on the edges of society, really. Yeah, you don't get the bull mentioned in the Merlin tradition. Stag image. So the kind of main animals you get in the Merlin myth, you get his pig, whom he spends pigs and boars he spends all the time talking to. You get stags and you get wolves, and then you get this very implicit thing that's implied rather than shown about Merlin as a bear connected to the bear lineage. But that's hardly mentioned. That's implied by the chaining up to a pole, right? To a medieval reader would read as the chained bear trying to get free and back to his home in the forest. Yes. Yeah, no, totally. So that there's that again, that kind of animal energy, that the mysterious energy that drives him forward to the high place that he falls from, really. Rob, sorry, you want to say something as well? Eagles are in there. There's a whole section on birds, some magical birds. So that, you know, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well, we're not yet done with Merlin. We're going to come back to Merlin. There's a whole other thing which my good friend John Matthews, with a friend of his, translated another book of prophecies called The Prophecies of Merlin, which is a medieval manuscript that came to life. So I'm going to look at a little bit of that next time. And this is a... well, superficially, but again, it's one of these things that look superficially a bit easier, but once you get into it, there's a whole... The thing about Merlin that's important to get, right, is the servant of the Weaver Goddess. He is this magical shape-shifting being who's connected with the idea of the service of the Goddess, connected with the idea of establishing sovereignty, and of creating order out of disorder. But in that process, he is this catalytic figure that breaks everything down, that turns everything upside down, and that enables a new order to arise out of the disorder. So even in this, the story of Mallory, he does this what sounds like kind of quite you know, pretty unpleasant thing of putting the shape of Igraine's husband upon Uther, so that Uther gets to sleep with Igraine and give birth to Arthur, whom Uther has then promised that Merlin can have possession of. So there's this deep weaving of things that can be disturbing, really, that is about exposing us to ideas that turn us upside down and inside out. Rather like that phrase, root and branch shall change place. And the newness of things shall be a miracle. Ali, what have you just asked? Ali's just sitting with me. What have you asked me there?
Perhaps a link to the association with the bear was a link to Arthur.
Yes, it is. So Ali is quite, just before we finish, Ali is quite rightly reminded me that, of course, Arthur's name is also connects to the idea of being a bear. So in the deeper tradition, Merlin is also a king connected to the bear lineage. Arthur, in a certain sense, is the king that follows after him, who is the bear king. Just as in a certain hidden way, Merlin is the bear king. Mm-hmm. Just to throw that into the mix as well. Just before we finish, we're slightly over time. I'm just going to give you 2 minutes more. The bear lineage idea goes right back into the Bronze Age, right across Europe, right back into the beginnings of Homeric Greece, where we find a figure called Parmenides, who is the archetypal bear shaman, whose writings are all about being and becoming, and therefore all about Anoki. And connects the whole world of the Celtic world with the Homeric world of the Iliad and the Odyssey. So, more on that to come. But just to leave you with the thought that the service of the weaver goddess is connected also with this image of the bear lineage, who are the defenders of life, defenders of the tree of life, who are themselves those who descend into the depths, into the dreaming. The main thing above all we know about bears is they hibernate, they go into the great dreaming. One of the things that we know from the Mabinogion is that Math Sanamathonwy, who is the great magician of the Mabinogion, his name is Bear, the son of the one who is like a bear. So he is the bear incarnate. We have Arthur, who is the bear king, and we have Merlin, who stands behind Arthur. And behind them both stands the weaver goddess, who turns up later as Morgan le Fay in her weavings, manipulations, but who in Geoffrey's version of Morgan is the great healer who receives him into Avalon. So, there we go. That's it. Let's just pause for a moment while I just thank the archangels, and we'll... All right. Okay. So I'm just going to, I think we need to finish because we're just 5 minutes past our time. So let's just not be too worried about all the stuff we've just gone to. But just allowing it all to kind of settle in us, in our bodies, in our hearts. Not having to understand it too much, just trusting the experience we've been through. Coming back to that sense of Anokhi, of I amness. Being aware of the archangels, of their I amness. So sitting together, sensing our bodies, trusting our bodies, trusting whatever we have received is sufficient, letting it settle inside us. Then from our place of I amness, paying attention to the archangels. Seruviel, weaving angel, we thank you. Go in peace. Oriel, we thank you. Go in peace. Gabriel, we thank you. Go in peace. Mikael, we thank you. Go in peace. Raphael, we thank you. Go in peace. May we all go in peace. Thank you very much, everybody.
Can you say goodbye
for
me?
I'm going to say goodbye for Ali. Ali got chucked out of the internet. I'm sure she's sitting beside me, really. Not that she can work in.
There's Ali.
A group way,
which is nice. Okay, so just put everything up from both on the website and on PeakLoad. So hopefully one of either PeakLoad or Firefox. You will need Firefox if you're going to try and get it from the website because the other things aren't working. So hopefully one of those will work. We'll have to see. But, I've also sent, because of my wonderful MacBook P-Loud as opposed to PeakLoad, what I'm now recording on, it also enables me to produce transcripts, quite summarized transcripts from, which is partly what I've been sending through. So which hopefully will give a summary of the things that we've looked at over the weekend. It's got a truly wonderful AI system, and I proved it to me with Pila. It is amazing. I have to correct it a little bit, but hardly at all. It is an amazing bit of kit. So it enabled me to produce transcripts, which otherwise I just couldn't. It would just be far too laborious. Maybe that'll help people with my book. Who knows? Live in hope. Live in hope.